Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. From its creation, Americans have had an uneasy relationship with the FBI. Pride when they caught the bad guys. Dismay when they overstepped. Fear among many when J. Edgar Hoover held the reins. And the FBI today? Still out on the edge, out on the job, now looking to preempt terror attacks. And more this hour on Point, secrets of the FBI. You can join the conversation. Have you seen the FBI at work lately? What do you see? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Later in the hour, we will look at a new lead the FBI is looking into in the 40-year-old case of D.B. Cooper, the skyjacker who jumped out of the back of a Boeing jet with parachutes and a lot of cash decades ago. But first, joining me from Washington, D.C. is Ronald Kessler, former investigative reporter for The Washington Post, best-selling author of books on the FBI, the Secret Service, the CIA, and more. His new book is The Secrets of the FBI. Ronald Kessler, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
So, secrets from what era? Where are you really looking here? Are you looking back at Ruby Ridge or the problems at Waco or even the America's Most Wanted Whitey Bulger who's just been arrested? Where's your focus, Ronald?
I cover all that, but the idea is the FBI, whether directly because of investigations or indirectly because of their involvement in all kinds of other things, knows more secrets than anybody. And so whether it's from the Hoover era or up to date with the bin Laden killing, I reveal things that have never come out. For example, during the Ken Starr investigation, the FBI agents who were assigned to that looked into the whole Vince Foster suicide. He was the deputy White House counsel under Bill Clinton. And what they found was, yes, he did commit suicide. Excuse me. But what triggered the suicide was that about a week before his death, Hillary Clinton had a big meeting in the White House with Foster and other White House aides, and she disagreed violently with a legal objection that he raised about her health care legislation. And in front of all these aides, she totally humiliated him, said, "You're just a small-town hick lawyer. You'll never make it in big time." After that, his demeanor totally changed according to what the FBI found. He would become very withdrawn. He would break into tears, and a week later, he committed suicide. And so on the record, the FBI agents who investigated this say that that is what triggered his – of course, he was already depressed, but that is what triggered his decision.
So you're saying that you've got the answer to why Vince Foster did it on the basis of FBI records. Do you take those as gospel?
This is FBI interviews with the actual people who were in these meetings who were friends of Foster and aides in the White House. So, you know, you can accept that or not as you wish. Another item is that just after Marilyn Monroe's suicide, a teletype came into headquarters saying that from the head of the Los Angeles field office saying that he lent his personal car to Bobby Kennedy, the attorney general, to go and see Marilyn secretly just before her death. And I confirmed with his children that, in fact, on a regular basis, he would lend his car to Bobby to see Marilyn. Now, whether he possibly broke up with her just before her death and that's why she committed suicide, I don't know. But this is another little tidbit that never came out. I think the most astonishing material in the book, though, is how the FBI breaks into homes and offices to plant bugging devices, even into embassies to plant bugging devices without getting caught and shot as burglars. And this could be a mafia home. It could be a terrorist hangout. It could be an embassy, as I mentioned. But on the night of the break-in, they will know beforehand from conducting surveillance who goes in, who goes out. So on the night of the break-in, they will watch anybody who might be at home and might possibly go back to this premises.
And how often is this happening in a year?
There are about 400 of these a year.
Okay.
You know, for example, with the Zazi terrorist case in Manhattan where he was going to blow up subways, they broke into his car and made a copy of his hard drive.
Mm-hmm.
That's one example. But on the night of the break-in, they will, if the person tries to go back to the premises, they'll divert them. They'll either dress as police officers, and by the way, this is all court authorized, dress as police officers and stop the person, or they'll stage a phony traffic accident, or they will open a fire hydrant in the area so nobody can go back. And also before the break-in, they will take a photo of any dog that might be in the premises. And they will show that to a veterinarian who's on contract, and he will prescribe just the right amount of tranquilizer to put the dog out with a dart gun before the break-in. And then at the end of the break-in, they'll wake up the dog with another shot that wakes him up. They bring their own dust just in case they have to disturb some dust on a tabletop or desk. They will actually create phony fronts to homes or townhouses by taking a photo of the front, then blowing it up into a big tarp. And then they put the tarp over the front of the place. During the night, they go behind the tarp, pick the locks, defeat the alarm system so that no bystander on the street can see them.
So literally, I'm looking in up the driveway through the trees, I see the house, but it's actually a gigantic photograph of the house rolled out.
Exactly.
In front of the...
Exactly. You know, they have very sophisticated engineers, machinists, et cetera, who do this work in a top-secret location in Virginia.
You talk also, about an outfit called Stagehand at Quantico in Virginia that sort of outfits them with, well, you tell us.
That's it. Well, let's say they need $2 million in cash to show a bad guy, a mafia guy. They will arrange it. Let's say they need a yacht, where they might stage a phony yacht party so that the occupants of a mafia hangout or some other corrupt location will go on this yacht with these gorgeous female FBI agents who are very friendly. And that will keep those bad guys out of the premises while this operation, which is called tactical operations or TAC Ops, installs the bugs and looks in the computers and generally has a good time.
400 times a year this is going on, more or less, on average, you say. What are the primary targets for this? What are they looking for? Is this terrorism-related? Is it white-collar crime-related? Is it straight-up, you know, burglary-related? What kind of targets?
It's any really high-profile case. They wouldn't do it in a more routine case, but it could be terrorism. The terrorist who wanted to blow up the George Bush's home in Dallas, they put bugs in his apartment, and the difficulty there was that he had roommates. They had to make sure that the roommates weren't there when they put the bugs in. It could be a mafia place. Now, another technique is they will introduce static on the line of a mafia figure. He will call a repair service.
Mm-hmm.
The FBI will intercept the call, pretend that they're repair service, and say they'll be right over. And sure enough, they come right over in a telephone company truck wearing telephone company uniforms. And they sure enough, they fix that phone, but they put a bug in it as well. When John Gotti was taken down, the FBI installed electrical outlets to replace the ones in his social club, and they had bugs. And the beauty of that was that the electricity, of course, powered the bugs. The FBI actually showed me a real bug. I couldn't believe it. It was the size of a postage stamp, a little bit thicker. It will record for 21 hours or transmit as you wish in stereo.
Mm.
You know, when I was being given this, I actually thought to myself, am I going to be arrested or are they going to be arrested? But it turned out that Bob Mueller, the FBI director, approved giving me this material. And there are some funny stories that are just amazing in this book about TAC Ops.
Let me ask, though, I mean, in most cases, this kind of extreme measures of rolling a tarp in front of the place or flooding the street or staging an auto accident or $2 million on a yacht, not necessary. For most of their taps, they just call the phone company, flip a switch, and they've got what they want. Isn't that so?
That's right. And that is the way it's done today, of course. In the old days, they would actually have to climb a telephone pole and install a bug, and they still do that in you know, maybe 1 or 2% of the cases out in the country. But generally, all I do is they have an electronic system with each of the phone companies. They show that they have a court order. The phone company will just make the connection electronically.
To and then any FBI office in the country to listen.
That's right. It goes by internet, actually, encrypted, of course, to the FBI engineering research facility at Quantico. That's a big euphemism for their big bugging hangout. Mm-hmm. And then they, in turn, send it to the field office.
Do you have a sense that this is all being used legally, responsibly? I mean, there have been some reports that some of the Patriot Act authorizations, which were quite broad, intercepted way more than they might ever conceivably, by some standards anyway, need to do their job.
Well, certainly under J. Edgar Hoover, we had a lot of abuses. There was illegal wiretapping. There was political surveillance. There was gathering information for blackmail purposes against members of Congress and presidents. And I actually document that on the record from agents at the time. For example, John McDermott, who was the head of the Washington field office at the time, said on the record to me that, yes, that's exactly what we did. And he described how it worked. I quoted
they would go to the congressman as if sympathetically and say, "Congressman, we've learned this. We just want you to know we've learned this."
That's right.
There was no threat articulated, but then the congressman knew they had it.
And that's all that was needed. But they would actually go further. In one case, Roy Elson told me on the record he was administrative assistant to for Senator Hayden, that Hayden was against giving Hoover more money for his new FBI building. So the FBI sent an agent to see Elson and said, "Oh, by the way, we understand you're having this affair with so-and-so." And Elson said on the record that, yes, he was married at the time, but he said to this agent, "Well, I hope you have photos because I want to show the boss." And that was the end of that blackmail attempt.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking today about the inside life of the FBI in the era of preventive law enforcement, trying to stop crimes, terror attacks before they happen. Of course, there is a lot of history here. Ronald Kessler is with us. His new book is The Secrets of the FBI. Let's hear that voice. He was the voice for decades of the FBI, J. Edgar Hoover. Here he is in 1940, addressing the American Legion and warning of the growing threat of subversive forces in the United States.
"All people are accustomed to taking liberty for granted. As a result, they have ceased to think seriously about it. But the foes of America have much to say about it. They construe liberty as a license and clamor for even greater license. Liberty and license are as far apart as liberty and tyranny. License breeds tyranny."
And the FBI took a lot of license in the days of J. Edgar Hoover. Ronald Kessler joins us from Washington. Ronald Kessler, it is interesting that just recently, less than a couple of weeks ago, Robert Mueller was given a couple more years as director of the FBI. This was a big deal because after the era of J. Edgar Hoover, a 10-year limit was imposed in the post-Watergate era because nobody wanted to see an FBI director accumulate as much clout and instill as much fear as J. Edgar Hoover did in his day. Why has Mueller been given this extra length of leash here, Ron?
Well, there was a realization that this just was not the right time to replace the FBI director. When Mueller took over, it was just a week before 9/11, and he was faced with this horrendous situation where the computers were a mess. Nobody really had an idea of who the terrorists might be, and he had to learn the FBI step by step. It took a year or two before he really got a hold of it. And you know, to replace the director now where Al-Qaeda is probably plotting another attack for this September and confirmation hearings just would not be a good idea. And the fact is that Mueller has done a superb job. Since 9/11, we have not had an attack. And the major reason is the FBI, as well as the CIA, which gives tips to the FBI. Every few months, the FBI announces arrests of terrorists. They're not always on page one, but that is an indication of what they're up to and what kind of job they're doing. It's become very prevention-oriented. Of course, the FBI always wanted to stop plots, but Now, I interviewed Art Cummings, who until recently was in charge of counterterrorism and counterintelligence. And he says that now if an agent says he wants to arrest someone, Art will say, you know, you could be putting the country at risk by doing that. We want to find out what he knows. We want to get leads to new plots. And that's the emphasis. So putting someone in jail is now the least important goal of the FBI.
Of course, that means more and more surveillance of people who they believe, or rightly or wrongly, may be dangerous. If they're not arrested, they're not into that whole realm of reading them their rights and all the rest. You quote Mr. Cummings saying that he'd much rather have, you know, the hooks in before an arrest. He says, you're quoting him, how do I get to what's really happening? There are so many different ways to do it, but the best way by far, he says to you, is by sitting across the table from someone. The best thing is when you're sinking your fangs into his neck and he's smiling while you do it, because you convince him that he's doing what he's doing is in his best interest, when in fact it is absolutely not. Rosemary in Charlotte, North Carolina, you're on the air with Ronald Kessler.
Hi, Tom. Nice to talk to you.
You too.
I'm calling because of an incident that happened with one of my students. he had a high security clearance from his country and ours because he worked with America. And on his trip back to Saudi Arabia, he was strip searched here in Charlotte. And was quite upset about it, of course.
Was this on his way back into the United States after a visit?
No, he was in the United States leaving for Saudi Arabia.
And strip searched on his way out?
On his way out, yes.
Okay.
And after that, we maintained periodic phone contact, and I had the feeling that my phone was being tapped. I had a static. I heard funny clicks once in a while, but, you know, I was super suspicious.
Well, let me say right away that if you heard that, then definitely the FBI was not wiretapping you, because they do a very good job. You know, what one funny thing that
Hey, one second, Ronald. What's your bottom line here, Rosemary? What's your conclusion?
I want to know if I can use the Freedom of Information Act to find out if, in fact, my phone was tapped.
Good question. Ronald Kessler.
No, that would definitely be an exemption under the Freedom of Information Act. That would be totally secret. Of course, the whole point of the wiretap is to do it secretly, clandestinely. By the way, the FBI was putting a bug in a mafia hangout in New York, and it was behind the social club, and there were these iron gates, and they were rusted. The lock was rusted. It was, of course, after midnight, and they had to bang on this lock to open it. And they already were bugging a mafia apartment next door, and they picked up on this other bug. These mafia people listening to the banging and saying to themselves, you know, I wonder if that's the FBI. No, the FBI would never be that clumsy.
So I mean, you're making these guys out as incredibly clever. Rosemary's a little worried about it. Let me get one more here. Chesapeake, Virginia. David, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Yes, sir.
Just to address the caller that just spoke a second ago, there's only one thing that I know of that you can use to check if it's something that's going outside of the phone company, to see if your line is being monitored, is what they call a drop meter. You know, and there's directions that can tell you if someone's tapping your phone line. Other than that, it's hard to tell, as your guest has explained.
Yes.
The reason I called in is, you know, listening to your guest, you know, talking about some of the stories of FBI. I worked for a company out of Vienna, Virginia, for some time, and one of the specialties that we did and we worked on was corporate espionage in the United States, as well as tactical surveillance and countermeasures. And what that basically is going in and for the client and looking for wiretaps and bugs.
Right.
We had a case, a client out of California. I won't give the too much specifics.
Yep.
But we turned out it was the mafia, and we always called. My boss always made phone calls out of Virginia because it's one party consent, and he always called the FBI field offices local to where we were doing a job and asked them if they had any bugs or wiretaps.
Right.
This particular agent explained no. So we went out there. Sure enough, we found a 1970s wiretapping device and removed it and categorized it, disassembled it, and notified the client.
This was a bug on a. Are you saying a mafia location or something else, David?
Or, yes, sir. Okay. We found a wiretapping device, very old, FBI issue and government issue, and it was, you know, located on the mafia's
That's a long duty for that device. What's the outcome?
Yes. Well, a little bit later, my boss gets called into court and gets subpoenaed to court. He goes in and basically makes the FBI agents looks pretty silly. About several months later, my boss leaves his house one day in Virginia, up there in Vienna, and I was with him. About 10 minutes later, his house blows up. It was a controlled explosion, only in his basement where all of his business stuff was, and his garage where he had some very, very expensive motorcycles and cars. One of them was one of the first Le Mans Ford GT40s from back in the Le Mans.
Hey, David, let's hold it right there. Stick with us. Ronald Kessler, does this sound to you like FBI tactical operations? Revenge.
No. You know, if FBI engaged in any abuse like that, you can be sure that it would come out. It simply is not something that would happen. Again, under Hoover, there were abuses. And it's certainly important to keep that in mind today, given the power of the government.
David, what do you say about that? Absolutely not, says Ronald Kessler.
At the time, we weren't sure if it was something where the FBI turned over to the mafia and, you know, to get them irritated and they did something. But it was, or if it was the FBI, you know, issuing a hit, scared the mess out of my boss and, you know, several of us that worked for the company. We went into hiding for about 2 years. The fact remains is that it was so controlled, so sneakily done, and some of the things that, you know, your guest was speaking of, you know, the things, the capabilities of the FBI, it's one way or the other, either both or one or the other was working together or did it solely to take revenge, in our opinion.
David, I appreciate your call. Ronald Kessler is with us. His new book is The Secrets of the FBI. He joins us from Washington. Ronald Kessler, stand by there for a moment, if you would. I want to bring into a conversation a colleague of mine here at WBUR in Boston, senior reporter David Boeri. He has been paying attention to FBI work and cases for a long time, in particular one that's been very much in the news lately, that of America's most wanted Whitey Bulger, who we all know that story about how he was recently found after many, many years on the lam. This is a story with Boston roots, but there are a lot of fascinating stories when it comes to the FBI. Some reflect very well on the Bureau, others not so much. David Boeri, thanks very much for being with us.
You're welcome, Tom.
So when you look, Ronald Kessler's bringing us a lot of FBI history here, some of it previously secret, some details that we may not have known before, a lot about tactical operations. When you look back over the FBI's work in the last, not the Hoover era, but the much more recent era, what do you see in terms of the arc of competence, efficiency, getting the job done?
This is not a problem of bad computers and not having the right science and computers and analysis. This is a fundamental problem with the culture of the FBI.
Even now.
And
what's the problem? Ron Kessler is looking at what sounds like a pretty adept, tactical anyway, operation.
What we see is the preeminence of authority over policies. Routinely, the FBI has violated its own policies at the behest of authorities. Now, for instance, James Whitey Bulger, perfect example of this. Their own informant guidelines said that, in fact, he should never have been used. You don't put somebody in charge of another crime organization into the top echelon informant program. He had said he'd never testify in court. That, too, is reason, according to the policies, why he should have been scrubbed. He was never scrubbed.
But local FBI operatives
and
used
national,
him in a big way.
And national, because the directive was break the mafia. So here you have authority over policies. They violated the policies. It's interesting. J. Edgar Hoover, who was a Presbyterian, always wanted to recruit students from Jesuit schools, Georgetown, Fordham, Holy Cross. The two virtues characteristic of Jesuits are what? Loyalty and obedience. And in some ways, look at the motto. It's fidelity, bravery, integrity, much like that of the Marines, semper fidelis. In fact, and there's nothing wrong with loyalty or obedience, blind loyalty is the problem. And too often in the Bureau, you have blind loyalty.
Ronald Kessler, if you look back over time, you can start with 9/11. We all remember all the complaints then about a failure to connect the dots. But if you look back, you've got the Waco problem in Texas in 93 and Ruby Ridge, which was kind of a mess. I mean, you can look back and see things that did not work out so well, including much more recently, you know, the out in Portland, Oregon, Brandon Mayfield story, arrested for involvement in Madrid bombings, you know, later cleared by the FBI, paid $2 million. And then issues about the exact nature of surveillance of American Muslims these days in mosques and whether it's got the right balance or goes too far. You hear David Boeri. He says there's an issue here over time in the culture of, you know, people just running away with their authority.
Well, that certainly happened in Boston. It was a disgusting episode in the history of the FBI, but it was local. It involved certain agents. There's no indication that this was directed by the head of the organization, and of course, these people are being prosecuted. And now Bulger has been caught by the FBI. There have been other problems, as you say. In Waco, they should have waited out the Branch Davidians and not until they ran out of food and not just rushed in. That was ridiculous. And the Branch Davidians committed suicide. But if they'd waited them out the way the FBI normally does, it would have turned out fine.
David Boeri, the Whitey Bulger story, just a local problem?
It's a national problem, and in fact, it involves Robert Mueller himself. Nobody's accusing him of wrongdoing, but for the last 10 years, the FBI fought all efforts to bring another agency in, namely the U.S. Marshals, to help them find Bulger. They refused to let them in. It is that loyalty to the institution, the instinct to protect the institution rather than get their man that's been a problem. Here. If I can, there's another example, Tom, that mm-hmm. I think is just a very, again, emblematic. It involves Brandon Mayfield. He's mm-hmm. a lawyer in Portland. After the Madrid bombings in 2004, investigators there found fingerprints. They put the fingerprints out digitally internationally, and suddenly from the FBI here, it was, "We got your man." They said Brandon Mayfield was the man. The Spanish said, "No, we don't think so, because the fingerprints, the curves and the concentric mm-hmm. rings are all wrong." The Bureau actually took it upon themselves to fly to Madrid to tell the Spanish how ignorant they were. The Spanish refused. They came back. They arrested him. They arrested him in Portland, Oregon. In Portland, Oregon. By the way, they never.
This was a Muslim convert and attorney there.
And that made them even more sure. His wife was Muslim. He mm-hmm. had converted to Muslim. He represented terrorists. By the way, in Madrid, they never availed themselves of the opportunity to actually look at the fingerprint. Mm. They held him incommunicado. They had a search warrant on his house. They found documents that they said were damning. They were in Spanish. It turns out they were the kid's Spanish homework assignments.
His child's Spanish assignment.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And it is that arrogance that we are the best, that we know what we're doing. It's so often the FBI is in the position, they look sometimes very foolish because of that rush to judgment.
That was 2004, Ronald Kessler, not 1954. What about that instance, the Brendan Mayfield
story? Well, I interviewed Art Cummins again on that. Mm-hmm. He was in charge of counterterrorism. He was in charge of that. He said that there was some mistake by the Spanish authorities about the fingerprints, and that led to this mistake. And eventually, of course, they cleared it up. Clearly,
with a formal apology and a $2 million payment.
That's
and
right.
An apology to the Spanish, who were outraged because they said it appeared to them that the FBI had it in for this guy.
Well, that's their opinion. The opinion of the person in charge was that there was a problem with the fingerprint imprint data that the Spanish provided. But the FBI was wrong in that case and certainly does make mistakes. In the end, almost everything that the FBI does is subjected to court review and trial. And so to that extent, it is accountable as well as to committees on the Hill, the Inspector General. But it certainly does make mistakes. On national security letters, for example, they had agents who transposed the telephone numbers by mistake. Sometimes they would go ahead without the full authorization. It wasn't some purposeful effort to intrude on people's privacy. In the end, they got what they were entitled to, but it still was an egregious mistake.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about the inside life of the FBI in the era of preventive law enforcement, trying to stop crimes, terrorist attacks, we're told in particular, before They happen. Ronald Kessler is with us. His new book is The Secrets of the FBI. My WBUR colleague David Boeri is with me as well in the studio. Let's go to Martha, calling from Boston. Martha, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
You're welcome. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question. Talk about snooping. There was an FBI agent around my house snooping, looking for an associate of mine. And I'm fascinated by the psychology of obtaining information. I was ready to tell this person my Social Security number. He asked where this associate was, and then I proceeded to tell him about the associates.
Now, this was an FBI agent who identified himself to you as such, Martha?
Yes, when I said, may I ask who you are, I believe he said FBI.
Mm-hmm.
I don't believe he said CIA, because I don't think
Well, if he was FBI, he should have shown his credentials, first of all. Secondly, he would know your Social Security number before he went out to see you. So
you don't have to tell him that one.
That was not FBI.
But you found yourself very ready to talk, Martha, and you're wondering, you know, how that dynamic is arranged?
Exactly. Why was I so willing to tell this person so much information about this individual? Is that something about humans, you know, psychologically? Is that something about the way the man was asking the questions?
Ronald Kessler, what do you say? Martha's been right there on the spot.
One of the good things about J. Edgar Hoover is he realized the power of publicity. He would promote the FBI as these supermen. He had the FBI series on TV going, which, of course, was totally controlled by him. And so it created this image of the FBI as being all-powerful, very patriotic, never make a mistake. And that image does help the FBI. People do want to cooperate with the FBI because of the image that it projects.
David Boeri, is that era of, you know, PR out front over?
Well, no, not at all. In fact, the genius of J. Edgar Hoover really was that public relations dictated what he did from the start. And yeah, we all remember Inspector Lou Erskine, otherwise known as Ephraim Zimbalist Jr., there out there. And in fact, there is that very positive image of the FBI agent. You have to say this about Hoover, despite all the flaws and the acts, he actually came up with, ironically, the most professional law enforcement agency in the country. And one of the things he did was he made sure that every supervisor in that office had 10 years of experience on the street before they came in. They were a competent lot. Not that they always did what you wanted them to do, but they were a competent lot. Nowadays, this level of competence doesn't exist.
In the FBI
In the FBI. And supervisors get promoted. They get promoted quickly. Once you're a supervisor, a special agent in charge, otherwise known as a SAC, I don't know if you could name one that's ever been demoted. It's protecting the institution, protecting the supervisors. When there are charges made, they go to the Justice Department Office of Professional Responsibility. Critics know it as the Roach Motel. What goes in never comes out. There's very little accountability.
Ronald Kessler, what about the competence in the ranks these days? After 9/11, if I may, there was a lot of talk about people signing up to join the CIA and the military, for that matter. But what about in these last 10 years, and who's coming into the FBI and how they advance in the ranks?
You know, FBI agents under Hoover did not have previous experience. Today, they generally do in a lot of different fields, such as accounting, any other professional field. So typically, agents are in their late 20s or early 30s when they join the FBI. Only 1 in 7 applications is accepted by the FBI. It's harder to get into the FBI than to get into Harvard. And, of course, they do routinely demote people, fire people. One example is under Mueller, Sheila Horan, who was in charge of counterintelligence, didn't give him the straight facts about a particular spy case in Los Angeles involving someone by the name of Smith. And he felt she was not forthcoming and was not on top of it and was not giving him the straight facts. Well, he removed her, which was quite different from Louis Free, who typically would shoot the messenger. If you gave him bad news or there was something he didn't like or you disagreed with him, he would demote you, even if if you were someone that he had promoted originally. And what that was why there were a lot of problems under Louis Free.
What about David Boeri talks about the generally very positive image of FBI agents, maybe, but then we've got listeners here. Who's one who's writing in on the website, On Point Radio? Irv says, I worked in Selma, Alabama during the Civil Rights Movement. We knew every agent who infiltrated our ranks. It was almost a farce. What were they looking for? Subversive people encouraging black people to exercise their right to register to vote? You know, that's the other side of the coin, Ron Kessler. Not such
The fact is that the FBI actually wiped out the Ku Klux Klan. They infiltrated the Klan, and that's why we don't have a Klan today, except maybe a few nuts here and there.
But, of course, Tom, they're also infiltrating the Quakers and the Christian peace movement as well.
Well, I wanted to ask about that. Ron Kessler, here's a Washington Post story from June 13th talking about an ongoing nationwide terrorism investigation with an unusual target: prominent peace activists and politically active labor organizers. What do you know about that? In the Midwest, this is reportedly centered.
Yeah, if the FBI has an indication that these people are up to some kind of criminal activity, for example, you know, maybe they're doing a peace demonstration that's totally within their rights, exercising their free speech, but there are a few people within that group that are planning some kind of destruction of property, then the FBI will go into that. And there's been no showing that, you know, despite newspaper stories that occasionally claim otherwise, that the FBI actually has, you know, tried to suppress these demonstrations without any probable cause to believe that someone wants to commit a crime.
David Boeri, how do you think we're going to look back on the Mueller era here? Louis Free was there. J. Edgar Hoover was there. Mueller's had it since 9/11.
He has had it since 9/11. And I've known Mueller because Mueller was here in the 1980s, by the way, which
in Boston,
as a assistant U.S. attorney, he was the number two guy during much of the problem here, although he didn't know about it at the time. I think he's a very honorable and respectable man. I think, though, that sometimes that loyalty to institutions makes one blind to what's going on and less than transparent in actions. You know, we need the FBI to be the top law enforcement agency in the country, in the world. Absolutely. We need more Ephraim Zimbalist Juniors out there. But the problem is, again, staying to policies and making sure that it's not authority, that policies that dictate, and that they're competent people. We want them finding, for instance, Zacharias Moussaoui, when he's up in the air over Minnesota,
absolutely,
only interested in learning how to fly the plane, not land and take off. We need somebody that can detect that. We had that person out there. We need that system to work.
Ron Kessler, how do you characterize the FBI era that we've been in, that we're in right now with Mueller?
Well, they are protecting us. That's the bottom line. But they do screw up. And one example of what David's talking about in terms of loyalty and allegiance to the organization is, in my book, I bring out the fact that the brother-in-law of Robert Hansen, the FBI agent who was a spy, warned an FBI supervisor in charge of Soviet affairs some 10 years earlier about Hansen, because Hansen's wife found this unexplained cash. There were a lot of other indications, and he really blew the whistle on him. And yet the supervisor never told anybody. And what confirms this is that when agents went to tell this brother-in-law, Mark Walk, who was an agent, about Hansen's arrest, the first thing he said was, gee, what happened to what I told you 10 years ago? Why wasn't that pursued? He assumed it was being pursued and it wasn't a good lead, but it turned out it was.
The Secrets of the FBI is the new book from Ronald Kessler. He joins us today from Washington, D.C. Ron, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
And David Boeri of WBUR here in Boston, thank you for joining us as well, David.
My pleasure, Tom.
In a moment, we'll look at the strange and still compelling case of the hijacker, D.B. Cooper. This is On Point. In November 1971, a man bought an airline ticket under the name Dan Cooper and boarded a flight from Portland, Oregon to Seattle. and bought himself a name in popular lore when he hijacked the plane and, long story short, apparently parachuted out the back of the Boeing jet with $200,000 in cash. Now the FBI is pursuing a new lead in the case. Joining me from Seattle is Casey McNerney, crime reporter for the Seattle Post-Intelligencer. Casey, thanks very much for being with us.
Of course. How are you, Tom?
Great. So what's put the D.B. Cooper story back in the headlines, Casey?
Well, there's a woman who's come forward. Her name is Marla Cooper, and she, along with her mother, are convinced that her uncle, this guy named Lynn Doyle Cooper, who was in Oregon right around the time of the hijacking, there's certain, at least among the family members, that their relative is the hijacker.
What makes them certain of this after all these years? It will be 40 years this November since somebody jumped out the back of that plane with a parachute and a pack full of money.
There's a lot of different things, although you're right that this is not the first time that we've seen a family convinced that their relative is the hijacker. It seems to happen quite often, and a lot of these people are certainly convinced that it's their relative. But in this case, what they say is that this guy had some money problems. The family kind of speculated that he might have been suicidal or at least not with it in order to jump. But this woman says that she was 8 years old around the time of the Thanksgiving time hijacking, and remembers her uncle coming home badly injured and all bloody and said that he was in a car accident, but then says she overheard another one of his brothers and her uncle talking about this hijacking, and then her own dad said, look, this is very serious, you can't talk about this, you know. And then when she started to research the case years later and talk to other family members, she remembered all of these details and came forward to somebody locally in Oklahoma City who worked in law enforcement, and then that person kind of checked out the story and passed it on to the FBI. And what seems to be interesting mm-hmm. is that in a lot of these cases, the FBI kind of investigates it quickly and then says, no, this doesn't fit because they're not the right height or the story's not believable or whatever the reason is. They have gone and looked for fingerprints on a guitar strap that belonged to this person, Lynn Doyle Cooper, and are now looking for other items that he might have touched because they couldn't get fingerprints off of that first guitar strap. And it seems interesting in this case, at least, because they haven't discounted him as of yet.
Here's a little sound. This is from just last week, Wednesday. Marla Cooper, she came forward on television claiming that her uncle, L.D. Lynn Doyle Cooper, was in fact the infamous skyjacker, hijacker, D.B. Cooper. Here she is on ABC News recounting a childhood memory in which she's watching her bloodied and bruised uncle come in from the woods.
I was spying on them from around the back of my grandmother's house, and I heard my uncle say, we did it. Our money problems are over. We've hijacked an airplane. They told my dad they wanted him to help them go back into the woods and find the money.
Go into the woods and find the money. Casey, how many leads has the FBI tracked down in the four decades since D.B. Cooper jumped?
In the four decades, they've tracked more than 1,000 leads, and most of them were early on. Now they say it's a low priority case. However, anytime you bring up anything about D.B. Cooper, it brings people out of the woodwork, and you get calls and newsrooms, and the FBI is certainly flooded with people who have their own theories. And it seems like it's one of those cases that really captures people's imagination, where they want to imagine this guy getting away, and he's certainly turned from a violent hijacker, at least in the eyes of the FBI, to somebody who's more of a folk hero, especially because they've gone through these roughly 1,000 people and haven't found anything substantial to say we can guarantee that this is the person. And because there's questions about the physical evidence in the case, and most likely because this suspect and other suspects that the FBI is looking at are dead, there's a question that maybe they won't ever be able to officially determine with forensic evidence that they know who the hijacker is.
What did they find on the ground? They found some of the money.
They did. That showed up in 9 years later, in 1980, there was a guy, a kid, who was vacationing with his family near the Columbia River, and he found packs of the money that was deteriorating along the Columbia River. And the only other evidence that they have, at least in the Seattle office that I've gone through, and it's pretty fascinating to look through, they've got one of the parachutes that he discarded, and they also collected his cigarettes. Another interesting thing is they've got his tie, which is this is so not James Bond like, but it's a JCPenney clip-on tie.
Okay.
And they were able to extract a DNA sample off of that in 2001. And
I had one of those back in the day. Do you think I might be a suspect?
You might be. Who knows? I mean, you might get the FBI knocking on your door like that caller earlier.
What do law enforcement people say when you talk to them just talking about this? I mean, do they think there was somebody who got away? Do they think he, I don't know, dropped into the forest like a stone that he bears ate him? What?
Well, there's a lot of things. There actually are people up in the Northwest who think this, that he was eaten by Sasquatch, but that isn't one that the FBI shares. But the FBI agents usually think that he died the night of the jump because, and there's a few reasons for that. One, that the money never got into circulation. Of the $200,000 he jumped with, the only money that's ever been found was what Brian Ingram, that young boy, found in 1980. The other interesting note is that when he had the demands in his hijacking, he didn't ask for large bills. And even the guy that packed the parachute, who I spoke to one time for a story, said, you know, this guy didn't really know what he was doing. And what the FBI says, you know, if this were a well-trained hijacker, he would have asked for $100 bills. But the way it was, that the money, which was given to him almost exclusively in $20 bills, weighed about 21 pounds, which they did on purpose to weight down his jump. And so because of those circumstances and because of you know, it was really cold that night and rainy, and he jumped into the backwoods of southwestern Washington.
And that may have been it right there. Casey McNerney with the Seattle Post-Intelligencer. We're out of time. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.